have two quotes for you today. Both, I think, are equally compelling, but one's probably a bit more quotable than the other based on the person who said that, and I think you'll understand why. The first, see, if you look at the drug war from a purely economic point of view, the role of the government is to protect the drug cartels. That's literally true. Milton Friedman. And the second one, the drug war is a total scam. Prescription drugs kill 300,000 people a year, while marijuana kills no one. But they spend billions of dollars a year, quote, fighting it, because potheads make for good little slaves to put into private prisons, owned by the banks who launder the drug money. And it's all documented. Alex Jones. Welcome, everybody, to a very special 10th episode of Court is in Session. I am Court Culver, and I am happy to have on my good friend, Alec Piergiorgi. And we are going to have a really interesting conversation. I can just feel it. So today is the 88th anniversary of the end of Prohibition, which ended on December 5th, 1933. So I think it's only appropriate that we take this opportunity to talk about the war on drugs, which I feel that Alec has some very strong opinions on, if I were to take a guess. So, Alec, I'm just going to start you off right in at the deep end. Should it be legal for a 7-Eleven to just sell heroin?
I would say yes, are horrific and supposedly have no beneficial aspects to them. Although I remember reading something a while ago about a guy that swears by recreational heroin use. But I think people should be able to buy these drugs in as safe of an environment as possible, and that's through commercialization in these stores, and maybe these drug stores aren't going to be as prevalent as 7-Elevens on every street corner, but they're definitely better than someone being stabbed in a back alley over a bad drug deal.
That's an interesting point that you bring up. So do you think that the drug war has done more to harm communities than rampant drug use would, or would you say it's about even, or would you say it's more of a principle on the thing that, you know, it's not worth looking at the cost benefit analysis of how many lives are being ruined by either the drug war or drugs themselves? This is just not a role for the government to play.
Well, I think any time that you want to understand any situation, it's always important to take a cost benefit analysis, but I don't know where you're personally coming from, but I'm not coming from a utilitarian or pragmatist paradigm. I'm coming from a more, I would say, moral paradigm of saying the government just has no legitimate role in regulating these types of activities. And I think when we take a look at, especially we can take the history of Prohibition as an example, the rise in organized crime that had to facilitate this demand that they were seeing consumers for these drugs. And since these are illegal, this just leads to these cartels popping up and these organized crime syndicates popping up. Whereas if they weren't, if they were legal, then we wouldn't be seeing these sort of back alley organizations. We'd be seeing legitimate organizations and all the sort of up-to-date, even if the government wanted to even have a role, they could theoretically have a role of having like the FDA and saying, listen, if you're going to make weed, it's got to have these specific chemicals in it or whatever. It's going to be heroin. It's got to be this like proportion of certain chemicals in there. That's still better than the situation that we have now where it's completely illegal. And there's a huge spike in these drugs that are spiked with other drugs that the consumers don't know that they're getting. And that leads to an increase in overdose deaths and illnesses, which we wouldn't be seeing otherwise.
So I want to back up for a little bit, because one of the things that you mentioned, at least as I understand the point you were trying to make, is that the illicit drug trade is one that gives organized crime a lot of power in society, right? And it kind of ruins a lot of neighborhoods and things like that. And it's the cause of a lot of violence and death. And that's a point that I've brought up to people. And one thing that people have said back to me is things like, well, if it wasn't drugs, it would be something else. It would be human trafficking, which of course already exists to a big extent, or it would be some other thing. Gangs are able to, they would be able to survive off of some sort of other illicit practice, and it's got nothing really to do with drugs as much as that's just the way that these operate. So do you think that there's any weight to that, and we wouldn't actually see any kind of we wouldn't see less drug violence or any less gang violence with the legalization of drugs, or do you think that it would in fact go down?
I just think that when the person that you're speaking to brings up the example of, you know, human trafficking, or they would just do something else, I think it's a big difference between a person growing weed in their backyard and selling it illegally rather than keeping a human slave and selling it to somebody else. That's a huge difference in terms of scale and in terms of the type of person that gets involved in that. So I think that that's just a bad counterexample that they try to bring up. And I think the other issue is nobody really has sympathy for the drug addict or the drug user. At least not a lot of people do. You know, when they see a heroin addict, they see, oh, that's a person that, you know, that's their own fault or whatever. And there could be a million reasons why that person got addicted to heroin. I don't think anybody's happy that they're addicted to heroin. I'm not. I don't even think the people that are sympathetic towards that type of person are happy that they're addicted. It's just that that's where they're currently at, and it's about how we move on from there. And how do we prevent more people from getting addicted? If there is the lack of threat posed on that person by saying, hey, I want to get help, but I know if I go get help, I might get involved with the police, and that's not what I want to do. I don't want to hurt my record. I don't want to all this other crap. And that makes it harder for people to get the treatment that they need. There's also this thing where there wants to be a reduced stigma around drug use, and I'm sort of wishy-washy on that. I think that there should definitely be lower stigma when it comes to certain types of drugs. But I think for probably the harder ones like heroin, there should probably be still be a societal stigma where it's like, you really should not be getting into that in any scenario whatsoever. Okay. But if you are, then there has to be ways that you're just not going to die on the street.
So, in some bigger municipalities, some of the more progressive ones like New York and San Francisco, and I think there are a couple other ones, maybe Chicago's doing this, you're starting to see where governments are setting up these little zones where people are able to go get clean needles, things like that, and then get high in their little government-sanctioned space and be on their merry way. Is that an overcorrection of the stigma? Are those a good idea? Is that, again, just not something the government should be involved in? Is that a step in the right direction? What are your thoughts on programs like that?
Yeah, well, it's difficult. It's difficult when this is sort of one of those scenarios. Well, first off, before I go into that answer, I have not done extensive research on my own about these drug use facilities, but I know that they're existing, and I know that cities are setting them up. I think New York City just opened their first one. I haven't done much research into them personally about whether or not they are good or whether or not they work. However, this is sort of a government solution, a government problem, in a sense. And And the government is sort of correcting itself in trying to give these people a safe space to get high. And if they happen to overdose, there's someone right there to bring them back to life with Narcan. But would any of those people really be in this scenario right now if this drug was illegal to begin with? That's the difficult thing. And I'm not saying that just because the drug is illegal, this person is in this scenario. I think that there's a million reasons why someone might turn to drug use. And there's probably deeper issues in our society or in our culture about why we have such a huge opioid epidemic, why we have such a huge drug epidemic in this country. It's leading to all these unnecessary deaths and turmoils in families. There's probably deeper issues that can't be solved from the government just opening up a little courtyard for people to get high in.
So let's talk about the opioid epidemic. And I don't know how much research you've done into it. I've done a little bit. But one of the big things that happened during the opioid epidemic, and a lot of people blame this on lack of regulation, so I'd love to hear your take on it, is that these drug companies, you know, they were making these opiates, and they were able to make a pretty big profit margin on them, so they were advertising them very heavily to doctors, and doctors were getting kickbacks for prescribing them to patients. And what happened was people would be prescribed these opioids when their, you know, shoulder was hurting or they got hurt at work or something like that. And there was probably, you know, too much for them. It was probably a bit of an overprescription. And next thing you know, they were addicted to these pills. And from what I hear, heroin is a lot cheaper, and a lot of these harder drugs are a lot cheaper than trying to get new opioid pills on the street. Do you think that that is up to the free market, as it were, to hold these drug companies accountable? Or is there a place for the government to step in and say, we need to regulate this industry differently? I've heard people say you shouldn't be allowed to advertise drugs in the same way that you can advertise like a Big Mac on TV or something like that. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I think it's all about the type of government, society, or paradigm that we're talking about. Like, if we're gonna in this scenario, if we're gonna assume that there is a state that exists and the government does have a role in many of human activities, I know in Europe they have it where there's really none of this like drug advertising that we have here. But also in this situation, you know, even minarchists, as little as government as you can get, they still argue that the government has a role in prosecuting fraud. And it's very possible that in a lot of these drug scenarios that these families that are running these drug companies or these drug companies themselves, and then even the pharmacists, that they were involved in different levels of fraud about maybe hiding certain statistics or taking bribes or taking payouts. And then that they can be prosecuted through that way. There's also big questions about how the entire American healthcare system, how it's currently constructed, is leading to this scenario. And I mean, that's just a whole nother rabbit hole. But I don't think anybody is happy about the current situation and where it stands. The issue with the whole drug conversation is, you know, This is why, like, Ayn Rand was not personally, I think because of her political and philosophical position, she saw that the government had no role in this. But I think personally, she took a very hard stance against drugs because she despised anything that took you out of reality or despised anything that clouded reality to your vision.
Did this include alcohol as well?
Well, yeah, well, no, because she drank, but I guess it would be to the point where you're getting, like, blackout drunk, or you're getting just obscenely drunk, not just drinking to get a little bit tipsy.
She was Russian, but, after all.
Right, exactly. So I think it's a deeper issue of why do so many people feel the need to leave reality, or why do so many people want to obscure the fact that they're existing in our reality? And that's just like that's just a Leviathan. Like, there's so many different facets about why that's happening, about why people are feeling this way, why people are going towards drugs. But if we're always going to have that problem, and there's always going to be people that are going to seek out these drugs no matter what, we should have it be in a society where they're not thrown in prison for that. They should be able to get the help that they need and not be tormented, and then also not be pushed into dealing with the organized crime factions and going underground to get these drugs, when if they were legal, then we could be seeing what we're seeing now with the cannabis dispensaries, where they're very nice businesses. They're very high end. There's a ton in Tallahassee. Not a ton, but there's a decent amount in Tallahassee, like medical cannabis dispensaries, and they're legitimate businesses. And that's a lot. Even if you personally disagree with marijuana use, you have to admit that that is a better situation than somebody buying weed that could be laced with fentanyl, could be laced with whatever, in a back alley. To me, at least, that makes sense.
So what about somebody who would say, you know, I don't really care about all that. I personally am against, you know, marijuana use. You know, maybe they think it has some, it's some huge detriment to society. I'm personally of the opinion that it's really not. You know, the majority of weed smokers just kind of sit in their house and, you know, eat Cheetos and watch TV. Like, somebody's out there that says, yeah, it makes people work, and to legalize it would ensure that more and more people would use it, and then even like the harder drugs, should those be bad for you and it's detrimental to your health? And I think a lot of people, I think pretty much everybody knows this. And like you said before, nobody really wants to be in that situation. Do you think that it would lead to more widespread use, or do you think a majority of people would be able to think for themselves and say, I'm not going to do hard drugs, or the people that aren't smoking weed now wouldn't smoke it if it was legal?
Right. Well, I mean, where you're going is exactly what Ron Paul continually repeated during his presidential runs, and I think even in the 80s when he was saying this, I think in his 88 campaign, if that's right, and that's what he said to people. He said, well, are you going to take heroin tomorrow if it's made legal? I'm not going to. Would you? Or would any of you? Saying this to, like, an audience, I think. And it's, no, I certainly wouldn't. I, you know, it's up to personal discretion about how far you want to go. And for me, I don't know, maybe I'd go as far as LSD, psilocybin, maybe something like that, but that's a hell of a lot different than heroin.
Right.
Real world examples of, and I think the most recent one is Portugal, where at their national level, they decriminalized, I think, all of these drugs, and it's led to massive decreases in overdoses, decreases in related illnesses to drug use or unhealthy drug use. There also wasn't a massive increase in drug use. There just wasn't.
From what I heard, there was actually a bit of a decrease as it kind of got its, some of the drugs were like not as cool anymore because they weren't illegal. And it, you know, it wasn't a massive decrease, but I think it was something like 5% decrease in a lot of people taking these drugs. Because, and I, you know, part of it's probably because the stigma wasn't there anymore and you didn't feel as cool. But I think also part of it is like what you were saying before is, you could go get help. You know, if you run into a lot of legal troubles, even now, if you try to go get help, and because of this massive stigma around it, if it's been decriminalized, and there's so much less pressure of being able to go to authorities or being able to go to other places and being like, I have this issue, you know, I need help. And I think that that's, you know, very helpful for people who have problems with these drugs.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, if someone's addicted, then they don't want to be addicted, but they can't get help. And now they have the opportunity, because it's been decriminalized, that they can get the help. I mean, it's reasonable to assume that some of those people would lead to a decrease in the overall drug use. But it's also reasonable to think that there might be an initial spike in certain drugs as people say, oh, it's legal, let me try it now. That's also reasonable, but that doesn't mean that that's going to be a sustained or exponential increase in the drug use. Most likely, that's going to be a slight uptick and then a downtick and back to sort of an equilibrium.
So prohibition in this country of alcohol lasted for not very long. I want to say it was like 15 years or something like that. Why do you think that these drug laws and enforcement on things like, let's take weed, for example, have been around so much longer, and why it's so much more of a fight than ever was alcohol? Do you think we're heading in the right direction? Like, do you see an end in sight? Do you see marijuana being decriminalized in the near future?
Oh, yeah. I mean, 100%. I mean, we're already seeing that with the nullification going on, and already so marijuana is still, I think is still like a Category 1 drug at the federal level, yeah. I think. So we're already seeing nullification in practice from all of these states that have either decriminalized it for medical use or legalized it for recreational use. So it's only a matter of time before the federal government either just... My thinking is, the federal government is not going to legalize it at the national level. What they're going to do is they're going to take it off the Category 1. They're going to take it off that listing entirely, or they're just going to put it at a lower level, I think, whatever alcohol is. And they're going to leave it up to the states to say, okay, it's up to you now if you want to legalize it for whatever purpose. And then it'll be up to those states if they want to do referendums, which I think all these states so far have done, or by decree or whatever of the governor. And I think that that's sort of the inevitable path we go on. Because does anybody really see in the future a president sending his DOJ and attorney general onto the states to crack down on the states that have legalized it? I mean, that's a ridiculous size task. And it's just also impossible. It would be
and
cool.
For very little benefit. Like, at the end of the day,
right?
Okay, you've locked up all the potheads. Now what are you going to do?
Well, it would be cool, because then we get to see what these states would do. Would these states stand up and say, listen, we're not... What these states would do is that these states would say, listen, we're not helping the feds here. We're not giving the feds any sort of assistance when it comes to them doing this task of theirs, which is what they should be doing anyway. But that is probably what we would see. At least we'd probably see that from the more liberal states if it's a Republican president that's doing it. But I think it's really only a matter of time. And then that's marijuana. And then after that, it's probably going to be LSD or mushrooms or whatever. I think Washington legalized it recently, or at least decriminalized it. So that's probably next. But yeah, marijuana definitely is inevitable.
Speaking of states standing up, and this is a pretty far departure from what we were talking about before, but I'd love your take on it. The great state of Florida, my former state, which I'm missing more and more every day, is reestablishing their version of the National Guard. So first of all, Alec, have you enlisted yet? Second of all, is this something that states A should do and B will do more and more as the federal government seems to be taking over more things? Are states going to start pushing against that?
No, I have not yet signed up for Ron DeSantis's personal army. as much as I would like to, maybe if I had long-term plans in Florida, I would sign up for that. But, no, this is also something that a bunch of states already have. I think I saw somewhere that like a bunch of other states already have something like this. So it's not anything new that Ron DeSantis is setting up. It's, he's just reactivating something that had been dormant. But the what needs to happen is, and I what it has been happening, I think it's the Protect the Guard, I think is the movement. And they've been trying to pass legislation in a bunch of states, which is saying, listen, we have our state guards, and we're not going to let our state guards, which I think are part of the National Guard, we're not going to let our state guards be used for anything by the federal government. They're for the state, and that's it. The federal government has no power over taking our state guard people. I think it's Protect the Guard. I think that's what it's called. And so that's legislation that's trying to be pushed in a bunch of states to basically say, listen, the government has, the federal government has no jurisdiction over this, and they have no right to take over, take these people from us. And I think that's that's great. More federalization and more decentralized power to the states.
I wonder if that's legal, because I do believe that the most state guards are part of the National Guard. And I think if they're part of the National Guard, then, you know, a state can say all they want, like, oh no, you can't use it for federal purposes, but that'd be preempted by the president's commander in chief power. And basically there's a doctrine in Supreme Court jurisprudence that's like, well, if the federal government has a job they want to get done, like, the states really can't stand in the way. But that's why I think I think Ron DeSantis's personal army is different from that. And I haven't looked up to see if any, which other states have that. I wouldn't be surprised. You know, they just got rid of it, I think, in like the 40s or something like that. It's not something from like the, you know, the 1860s or something like that, that we had. So I don't know what the legality of protecting the National Guard would be at the state level, but I would think Ron DeSantis's army would be immune from all that. So it's interesting that he's doing it, and I wonder what he's planning on doing with it. So it's interesting to see. Do you think he's got any big plans for it, or is he just being Ron DeSantis?
Well, I mean, what would be cool is if he used it as the armed forces of Florida, and then using it as an argument for Florida to break away from the United States. I mean, that would be the best use of it. I don't know what other purpose it would have than that.
That was my thought when he started doing that. Like, holy crap, is he planning on seceding? I mean, they're already... They've made their own OSHA, which, you know, naturally that's the first thing a country has to have is an OSHA like structure. But, you know, it's okay.
Eggheads on construction sites.
Right. Exactly. But it's fun. It'll be interesting to see what he's planning on doing with it. If there's any state as of right now that I could see breaking away, it would be Florida. But I don't know.
Well, I think also Texas. I think Texas is above Florida in terms of breaking away. Because I was just listening to a podcast about this, and what they were talking about was in Texas, Texans have such an immense amount of state pride, and they feel so connected to their state. It's not really seen anywhere else. It's seen, I mean, I'm surprised by how much I see it here in Florida. I see it here in Florida way more than I ever saw when I lived in New York.
Right.
But I think Texas is by far and away above Florida in terms of that. Maybe not in terms of the current leadership, but I think probably in terms of the populace, they would be far more committed to that.
You don't think they're starting to get, you don't think they're starting to liberalize a little bit in Texas?
I mean, it's sort of a tricky scenario because it's all about who is going to Texas. Right. Is the people who are fleeing LA and fleeing San Fran and whatever in California, are the people that are fleeing those cities, are they the ones that are finally have a chance to get out, and that's why they're leaving? Or are they the ones that just have some other reason to leave? If they're the ones that are finally have a reason to get out, then those are the ones that are going to be more right of center, and so they're not going to vote more liberally. But you also are going to have a bunch of phonies who want to move to wherever the hotspot is, and those are going to be the people that vote liberal. But the people that are consistently voting liberal in those liberal cities in California are not really seeing any issues. You know, I don't know if you saw this, but Seth Rogen just had a Twitter exchange with Casey Neistat, Seth Rogen being the comedian and actor, Casey Neistat being the vlogger. And Casey Neistat said, San Francisco is a shithole city. I just had my car broken into. And thankfully the police got all my stuff back and they arrested the person. But this city sucks and I feel violated. And Seth Rogen responded to him and said, listen, man, this is ridiculous. Like, you can't be calling the city shit like this. I've lived here so long. And yeah, I've had my car broken into a bunch of times, but I never considered it an extension of myself. And that's literally what he said. So if that's the mindset that people like him have, then they don't see a reason to leave because right. They enjoy what's happening. Or they just think that it's some problem that can be solved with more of their liberal policies, which they know they're not going to get in Texas.
But that's Seth Rogen, though. I mean, if his car gets broken into, he can just get a new car. I mean, he probably lives in a really upscale neighborhood. You don't think that there are middle-class liberals that, you know, they'll talk a big game or whatever, but at the end of the day, they're like, you know, I'm looking out and, you know, this little park by my house, I can't bring my kid there anymore because, people are sleeping, you know, on all the playground equipment. You know, my car's getting broken into all the time. Like, I can't even leave gum in there anymore. You don't think people like that that aren't, you know, elites like Seth Rogen aren't leaving because you think they see no problem with that?
Well, then for that type of person, it would be a question of, does that scenario cause a shift, an ideological shift inside themselves, where they start to reevaluate their political positions? Or do they just have a sense of denial where they're like, oh, this kind of sucks and I don't want to live here anymore, but it's not for the reasons, it's none of the political reasons that I support. That's the big question. And if it's that, if those people leaving and going to Texas, then it's about which of those two they are. But the big cities in Texas have always been liberal. Like, Austin has always been liberal. It's always been known as, like, this liberal bastion in diehard conservative Texas. So, If those cities become more blue, then that doesn't necessarily mean that the state is going to overall become more blue.
I'll say this, though, about Austin, because people always say that, you know, Austin's, you know, liberal, you know, this liberal oasis in beat red Texas. But I say this all the time. Austin liberalism is different than San Francisco or Manhattan liberalism.
Right.
And I don't know if you've ever been to Austin, but, like, everybody's still carrying guns there. Everybody still, you know, waves, you know, they hang American flags everywhere, which I understand you'll see in, like, New York. But it's, I don't know, there's a sense of, you know, American pride there. There's, you know, people aren't just absolutely in your face obnoxious all the time. They just tend to vote Democrats. And even the Democrats of Austin are not really interested in having, you know, tents up all over the city. So I think there's a difference there, too, on what it means to be a liberal in Texas. Like, even Robert Francis O'Rourke, for a time, he wasn't super anti-gun. He kind of jumped on it because, you know, it would make him popular. And didn't he run for president at one point?
He was sort of pretty moderate until he ran, I think, for the Senate seat against Cruz. And then he went really progressive when he ran for the presidency.
Yeah, but I think even when he ran for Senate, the reason he went so progressive was so that he could get on a national stage and get a lot of national money. I don't think he himself is that ultra liberal. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he is just a phony, which is, you know, very much a possibility.
Yeah, well, I mean, that guy just seems like a fraud to me anyway. But I agree with you that, you know, being a liberal in Austin, Texas is different than being a liberal in San Francisco, California. You know, it's probably also a difference between being a progressive and being a liberal. Because that's probably, I mean, that's probably for your right that the Democratic base in Texas is probably a more conservative Democratic base than in California.
Yeah.
So just because the Austin turns a little bit more blue doesn't mean that that's necessarily the end of the world.
So all that being said, do you think within the next, let's say, 20 years, Texas is not part of the United States? Granted, the United States still exists.
I would certainly hope so. I just don't have any inherent sense in me that a good Balkanization of the U.S. or even just a Texas secession is gonna happen anytime soon. I hope I'm wrong about that. I just don't feel like that's gonna happen realistically. This wouldn't be as big of a situation if there was just more political decentralization and actual federalism back to the states. If the states just had more power and they were not under the thumb of the federal government so much, then this wouldn't even really be a conversation. So if, you know, in the next 20 years, if nothing changes, then I think there's probably a high likelihood that if nothing changes or the federal situation gets worse, then there's probably a really high likelihood that Texas will try to leave. But if there are successful movements to decentralize political power in the United States and shrink the size of the federal government, then I think that the likelihood decreases.
Can I give you my super optimistic view of what I think is going to happen?
Yeah, what's the white pill?
I think that's exactly what's going to happen. And I, especially if Roe v. Wade gets turned over this summer, I think what's going to happen is the conservative states are going to have an absolute heyday and the liberal states are going to have an absolute cow. And you're going to start seeing this bifurcation of state policies. You know, there's already been people on the left saying, like, well, I think California needs to secede, or blue states need to secede if Roe v. Wade is overturned. And I think there's just going to be this sense of, yeah, this isn't working anymore. And I think what's going to happen instead of just flat secession is a lot of people are going to look to what states like Florida are doing and what states like Texas are doing, where they're becoming more and more their own entity. And they're going to want to do this in the liberal states as well. And I think just by reason of them wanting to have more power to differentiate themselves at the state level, it's going to take away from the federal government. I think this presidency is making absolutely nobody happy. You know, obviously conservatives are pissed off all the time, but you're seeing things that are really ticking off a lot of liberals too. Like, you know, Remain in Mexico has just been reinstated by the Biden administration, and a lot of people on the left are really ticked about that. They're also really ticked that, you know, the Dems have had the House, the Senate, and the presidency, and have really gotten nothing done except spending a bunch of money on nothing. And I think people see that. And I think they'll say, look, we can get more done at the state level. And I think that in the end, federalism is going to win out. I genuinely think that.
Yeah. It'll be really interesting what the fallout is from this Supreme Court case regarding abortion, like you were talking about. Because, you know, it's up to the states where they want to draw the line. It's up to the states if they want to start enforcing, like, real nullification, which is a little bit difficult for the liberal states to do, because liberals have just been, anytime nullification has been legitimately used, they just refer to it as unconstitutional or extremist or right-wing or far-right, when it's really none of those things. But they're still doing it when it comes to their pot legalization.
Right.
So they don't seem to care there. So I guess if they want, they could still try to do that when it comes to abortion. Or, you know, this is why I don't, or this is why I was going to say that this is why I don't understand why more liberals aren't more in favor of secession. Because you would think, well, if you guys secede, then you don't have to worry about the federal government coming in and telling you you can't do, so you can just do everything that you want to do. You can just have all of your liberal achievements tomorrow, because they probably would be able to do that. But then I remember hearing, well, the left or the liberals think that they're winning. And so if you think that you're winning, why are you going to leave the game halfway through? So they don't think that secession is imperative, because they don't see themselves constantly losing. But conservatives or right wingers are seem to be far more in favor of secession, because I guess they feel like they're constantly at a loss when it comes to the federal government, which, I mean, they're probably right about. You know, the past, what, the 20th century for the United States has not been a history, has not been a massive victory for right-wing beliefs.
Now, the Overton window has moved left consistently for a very long time.
Right, and not even in a left-right paradigm, but just the role and size of government, and especially the role and size of the federal government, has not been in the favor of right-wingers, you know, for a while. So it makes sense that they're the ones that more want it.
I will just say this too, though. I don't think it's just that they think they're winning. I also think that they consider themselves like the police, and that they need to go around and tell all those ignorant Southern conservatives how they really need to be doing things. And they feel like they would be doing the world a disservice by leaving. I think that's why more people don't move to Canada.
Yeah, they're essentially just a bunch of like moral busybodies and savior complexes. And you kind of see this when people say, oh, well, you know, Texas wants to leave, or like, let's say, for example, Georgia wants to leave. Let's say Georgia wants to leave the union. Then one of the first things that they say, the liberals or the left will say, is, oh, this can't happen because it's going to lead to the subjugation of black people again.
Right.
It's going to lead to their voting rights being taken away again. And you really only see that being said by like these liberal white progressives, and it's this like white savior complex that they have, where for some reason they think that these black people are completely powerless. And right. These black people, these cultures of black people that have been living in Georgia for hundreds of years just have no political power whatsoever. They just they're just going to have their rights taken away and not do anything about it.
Right.
Which is absurd. So, but that's usually one of the first critiques that they have against secession. And then obviously they just bring like civil war back into it again.
Yeah.
You know, and it's impossible to have any sort of nuanced or interesting dialogue about the Civil War with anybody.
Why, you think it's just been done to death, or you think it just brings up
no? It's just.
Or it's like bringing up Hitler. You know,
To some people, it's bringing up Hitler, like. They have Hitler and the Confederate States of America in the same category in their head. Or it's just no, everybody is dealing with these, what I guess is the problem of history, but everybody is dealing with these caricatures. Everybody is fighting over these caricatures. Everybody's warring against these ideas that they have in their head that never correspond to reality. And that's certainly true for the Civil War. No matter what side you're on, nobody ever has anything deeper than a high school history textbook view on the Civil War. So it's just impossible to talk to people about it.
Well, we are coming to the end of our time here, but I like to ask all of my guests, and you know, this is your first time on, of course.
Right.
Is there anything you want to leave for the audience, for my one listener?
Yeah, for one listener, a lot of the time when I come to political discussions or sort of these arguments, I usually come from it from a more moral or philosophical grounding about what the legitimate role of government is. And for a lot of people, that's not going to work. Because for a lot of people, they've taken hook, line, and sinker that the government has these roles in our lives. So even if that's the case, there's still a lot of arguments to be made in support of what you and I are saying that only deal in utilitarian or pragmatist grounds. And a lot of the time, that's the stuff that's going to be more persuasive to a lot of people. So it's important that you have both sides that you can take. Because even if I think, the government has no role in dictating what people can put into their bodies, I can also say, hey, if that doesn't convince you, here's all this evidence from a more utilitarian ground saying, listen, this just doesn't work. Just what we're doing doesn't work. There's things that we could be doing that could be working better. And I think it's always important that people are aware that there's different methods of argumentation.
Alec, thank you so much for coming on the show. It has been my pleasure, and I hope to have you on again soon.
Yes, I look forward to returning at some point in the future. Thank you, Gordon.